Hi, folks. Denise Howell here. And next up on This Week in Law, Emery Roan, Mike Keyes, and Marty Schwimmer join me. We're going to talk about some of our very favorite things, such as magical unicorns, Cartman as Geddy Lee, LeBron James's tattoos, SpongeBob's ukulele, and much more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
Hi, everybody. It's time for our annual audience survey. We'd really like to hear from you. It helps us understand our audience better, know what you like and don't like, how you listen to the show. It also helps us tell advertisers what kind of people listen. But I promise you, your feedback is always kept personally anonymous. All you have to do is visit twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. It'll just take a few minutes, and it'll help us make TWiT even better. We really appreciate your support and any help you can give us. twit.tv/survey.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Emery Roan. Episode 338, recorded March 4th, 2016. 11 out of 10 would pet again. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by the Ring Video Doorbell. With Ring, you can see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. It's like caller ID for your home. Right now, get free expedited FedEx shipping when you go to ring.com/TWiL. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell. Thank you so much for joining us for This Week in Law, where we talk about everything that is fascinating, interesting, and important at the intersection of technology and law. We've got a great panel of folks to do that with, per usual. My co-host, Emery Roan, is here. Hello, Emery.
Hey, Denise. Hey, chat, and hey, listeners. Thanks for listening, and I am, as always, glad to be here.
Wonderful to see you again, Emery. Joining us again as well is a semi-regular guest and who I like to refer to as our trademark expert here on This Week in Law, Marty Schwimmer. Hello, Marty.
Hey, Denise. Good to be here.
Great to see you again. Everything going well?
Life is perfect.
Good. You were saying that before the show. I think that should be our motto today. Life is perfect, even though we have some troublesome things to work through on the show today. We can, if we bear in mind that life is perfect, we'll make it through. Also joining us for the first time, I'm pleased to welcome to the show J. Michael Keyes, Mike Keyes. He is from the Dorsey firm, Dorsey and Whitney, in both Seattle and the Bay Area. He's also the co-creator of the firm's IP blog, the TMCA. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Denise. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you on the show. I was so excited to be able to put you and Marty together. I understand you guys have crossed paths in the past, but it seems like you have a lot of common interests, expertise, intersection of ideas. So that's kind of neat when that works out.
Absolutely. I'm a big fan of Marty's. I've been following his blog for years. So great to be here with him too. Hi, Marty.
So you're my reader. Okay.
Thanks. I'm definitely your reader too, Marty. You've got at least two on the show with you today. Also, I wanted to give a shout out and an acknowledgement to one of our listeners who is Mike's brother-in-law. His name is Dr. Joseph Laith. He is a history professor at Edinburgh University in Pennsylvania. He's a fan of the show and a much-loved professor at his university. And he also is unfortunately diagnosed with terminal cancer at this point. Very big favorite at his school, and I wanted to play some video for you of Dr. Laith.
I've been blessed to live the life I love.
Dr. Joseph Laith spent 20 years of his life as a history professor at Edinburgh University. Last fall, he taught his last lecture, a result of his three-year battle with cancer.
When I left the classroom in December and I saw my students leave, you know, it was very hard because that was my identity.
His soft tissue sarcoma started in his leg in 2010. The cancer has now spread into his lungs.
We've stopped treatment and I'm just on palliative care right now, so I'm just making sure I'm not in pain and I get time with my family.
Thursday night, Laith says he had his last chance to give back to Edinburgh by giving one last public lecture.
I guess this is a last chance to say thanks.
Laith gives the gift of knowledge to faculty and students.
Life is a lesson, and so everything we can do along the way
compass. He says practice empathy. Be present. Don't give tests. Give lessons. Laith preaches if you love what you do, you'll do it well. His colleagues and students say that's their professor.
Someone who really genuinely cares about their students and what they become.
Thank you, Victor. That's great. We're so thrilled that you let us know about Dr. Laith. Mike, we're so thrilled that he enjoys the show. We like to think that we love what we do, and that's why we come back and do it week in and week out. It's the whole reason we're here, and so he has just wonderful wisdom for us all. We'd like to dedicate this episode of the show to him. Anything you'd like to add?
That's wonderful, Denise. I really appreciate that. I was with Joey and his family earlier this week, and he was delighted to know I was going to be on your podcast. And one of his specialties or expertise is dealing with crime and punishment in the U.S. So I think part of the program today is going to be of particular interest to him. So we're all here and polling for him, and glad that he's listening today. And thanks again for dedicating the show to him. That's very kind of you.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're so glad that he seems to be, you know, although struggling, obviously, and not in the best place of his life, probably, at least seems to be doing well and feeling well and on palliative care and living life to the fullest as we speak. So that's the best possible thing and great inspiration to us all. And yes, let's start with some topics that might be of particular interest to Dr. Laith and talk about the FBI versus Apple dispute.
So we've had some new developments this week that we wanted to bring you up to speed on procedurally as things stand in California. Nothing has really changed since we talked about this at length on last week's episode of This Week in Law. There's still a hearing scheduled for March 22nd in the Eastern District of California Court. And the parties' briefs are going to be filed in advance of that hearing. Apple's brief is on file. We learned last night, I'm sure that many parties will wish to file amicus briefs and may have already done so. If anyone knows of a central repository of the amicus briefs being filed in advance of the March 22nd hearing, I'd like to know about it. The San Bernardino County District Attorney last night or late yesterday filed an application to file their own amicus brief. And they are the first law enforcement agency to intimate what they believe may be on the phone in question. We haven't actually looked at their proposed amicus brief yet. What happens here is they file an application, they get permission from the court to file the brief. If the court gives that permission, the brief is then filed. And I think that's the point at which we'll get to see it. It hasn't actually been filed yet. It's been what's called lodged with the court. So it's sitting there. It's not part of the court record yet. The court has to agree, okay, yes, we'll accept and consider that brief. So that's where things stand with the San Bernardino DA. But we get from their application to file their brief that they believe there may be, and let me get the quote on this, a lying dormant cyber pathogen on the phone designed to infect the San Bernardino County offices network. So this is their theory of why information on the phone might be important. It's the first actual concrete thing that any law enforcement agency has said about what they believe might be on the phone. Now, you could come up with all kinds of things you might believe might be on the phone. I'm hoping that they have in their brief some sort of evidentiary support for that position, as Jonathan Sadarsky, who has written a lot about this on the forensic side of this dispute, he has a blog post up about how, you know, it might also contain magical unicorns. We just don't really know. You can speculate all you'd like about what's on the phone. What's on the phone really shouldn't be outcome determinative here. Anyway, that's a new development. Another potentially positive development for the Apple side of things is a ruling in New York where Apple was ordered to bypass the passcode security on a different device, Apple was asked to do that. The court was asked to issue an order similar to the one that was issued here in California. The court declined to issue such an order. Can you tell us a little bit more about what went on with Judge Ornstein's ruling here, Emery?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. So in this case, this was a really beautiful, wonderful shutdown by the Honorable Judge Ornstein of the government's arguments about their use of the All Writs Act. I think that my favorite aspect of this was that someone tweeted out that Judge Ornstein used the word absurd to characterize the government's arguments 6 times in the brief or in the declaration. So it's a great read. Essentially, this is exactly what everyone was saying, that this is a precedent-setting case. We're dealing here not with a terrorist case, but with a drug case. And Judge Ornstein said that clearly this is a precedent-setting use of the All Writs Act. The government's arguments that this is going to be tailored for one phone is just, ridiculous. And that he really argued against the underlying support, or he really argued that the All Writs Act just doesn't allow the government to have this kind of discretion because it just undermines the entire I'm trying to pull up the argument that he quoted directly. But he said that something to the effect of it's absurd to think that the founders, when they were creating the All Writs Act, created it to directly undermine the constitutional work that they've just done over the past decades. So I'm right there with Judge Ornstein. Obviously, this is a New York case, so it's not going to be determinative at all for the San Bernardino case. But the ruling was really, really scholarly written. It was very well written, very well argued, and it looks like it's at the very least is going to be taken into consideration and could provide a roadmap for looking at this case moving forward.
Right. How this works is these judges are basically at the same level of the federal judiciary. They're both district court judges, which is the trial court level of judges in our federal court system. And so they don't have to follow what one another does. But if one has ruled on an issue very similar to something before another judge, they may at least take it into account. They may look at it and decide if they agree or not agree. So that's what we could see happen here with this New York determination. The other news from our episode last week, the thing that has happened in the intervening week here, is there was a hearing in the House Judiciary Committee about cryptography, 4 hours long. It's available on C-SPAN if you want to slog through it. We have some links in our discussion points for today's show if you'd like to have more of a summary of what happened before the Judiciary Committee. You can look those up at tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. Four or five folks summarizing what happened there before the House Judiciary Committee. And really, again, that won't be determinative at all on what happens before the judge in Riverside County at the district court here in California. It's just indicative of the fact that one of the initial points Apple makes in its brief that is pending in this case right now is this is a topic of national debate. It's something the legislature is grappling with, and that is why the House Judiciary Committee is having a hearing on it. The legislature is trying to decide what level of legislation on encryption is important, and one of Apple's key arguments here is that's the legislature's job, not the job of the judge in this court who should decline to enforce the order that she's already issued. Marty, any thoughts on all this?
I defer to your greater knowledge on this. I'm just a bystander.
Okay. How about you, Mike?
Well, I think it obviously raises some very interesting issues. I did have an opportunity to listen to some of the testimony last night. Director Comey, from my perspective, I thought was pretty forthcoming and pretty forthright in his position. And he's saying, look, and acknowledged, look, this is a very important issue. I think at one point in his testimony, he said, I don't know that we have the answer, and wasn't strongly advocating one position or another, but it's very interesting. We have two different courts from two different parts of the country that have come out in opposite ways on the issue. So it's going to be very interesting to see how this all plays out.
Yeah, it sure is. Anything else to add, Emery? I think we've pretty much wrapped up. Oh, I did have one other thing to point out that I thought was interesting from my reading on everything I just summarized for you folks, is that Jonathan Zdarsky's post goes into probing the truth of or the believability of what's being asserted by the San Bernardino County DA about this lying dormant cyber pathogen that they have put in their application and suggested might be there. And his technical take on that is, assuming for the sake of the argument they're right and there is some sort of malware that could insinuate itself into the San Bernardino County office's network, that would mean that the phone was jailbroken. And if the phone is jailbroken, that eliminates the need for Apple to do what Apple has been asked to do. Did you pay attention to that, Emery?
I didn't read that particular post. I mean, it makes sense. I think that one of these things that is, how do I say this? I think that one of the, cryptographer's brief, I think, is linked to in one of our show notes, talks about the real difficulty that is underlying the demand or the, you know, demands on the government that, you know, this is Apple's standard business. Apple builds software for a living. And so, you know, it's trivial for them to build this, you know, work around this, you know, security measure. And that the jailbreaking argument is showing that, look, Apple has been trying to button down the hatches on their operating system forever. And every single version of iOS up until today's 9.2, I think, has been jailbroken. That means that, you know, the argument that, okay, well, if the if Apple builds this tool for the FBI to use on this one device, it'll only stay on this device, it'll only stay with the FBI, is really scary. You know, it's not necessarily something you can rely on, because it is possible that once the tool is built, it can get out. I think that this particular case is so interesting because in a lot of ways, it's not the traditional backdoor that we've thought of. You know, James Comey characterized it as saying that, you know, there's always a door. We're asking Apple to remove the vicious attack dog so that we can brute force the door. And I know that Steve Gibson over on Security Now also talked about the finer points of having a workable definition of what backdoor means. In this case, remember that we know it is totally possible that Apple could build a tool that would unlock this particular phone, and that tool would not be used. Could not be used to unlock everyone else's phone. So it's not like we're talking about backdoors for everyone's devices. We're talking about backdoors for this device. And I think that it's definitely a backdoor, regardless of how FBI director characterizes it. It's, you know, getting around the intentional security. But what this is really underlying is, you know, the title of the hearing on this past Friday, or that what we're just talking about on C-SPAN, is, you know, balancing the tightrope between encryption and privacy. And like, that's the underlying argument. We're talking about the legality of having these encryption measures on your devices and having companies that sell encryption like this, which is exactly what we were talking about a decade ago in the, you know, first crypto wars. And I think that I am obviously biased, but at this point, it doesn't feel like there can be much of a balancing act because, again, it's math. We're criminalizing math. And, you know, one of the things that has come up today, for example, has been making waves that Amazon has on their devices, their Fire OS Android-powered tablets, have recently updated to version 5.0. And any device that was using full disk encryption on Fire OS up until 4.8 or whatever the version before 5.0 could use full disk encryption. But now when they update, they're getting a notice that says that encryption is no longer supported by Fire OS. And that's really alarming. The idea that this could be setting a precedent for just pushing companies to roll back on security measures that we know work. This is only going to undermine security for everyone. And again, It's math, so it's trivial for bad actors to use good crypto. It doesn't feel like there's any balancing here, but I'm not the one, you know, speaking to Congress. So,
right. It does. One of the points Jonathan Zdarsky makes, I encourage you to check out his post. That's called "On Dormant Cyber Pathogens and Unicorns." One of the points he makes is that even though in their application, the San Bernardino County District Attorney's Office tells the court they have permission from both Apple and the U.S. Attorney's Office to file this brief that is supposed to be supporting the U.S. Attorney's Office's position, that if you take at face value what they're saying, that we're worried about there being some sort of malware on this phone and we're looking for evidence of that, that number one, it would mean that the phone was jailbroken for it to even be there. Number two, if the phone is jailbroken, the government should certainly be able to see what's to the extent that that's on there. They should be able to see that already, that it's only the personal data files of the user that the encryption would be protecting. So he has some interesting points to make there, and some points that might, you know, if the court gets its teeth into that, actually wind up undermining their support of the district attorney, or I'm sorry, the U.S. attorney's position, because I could certainly see a court saying, well, you know, you told me this order was necessary. If I, the technical understanding that I'm now given to believe means that it's not, and that you don't really need to go down this road. So, you know, courts like to find an easy way out of a hard situation. And I could certainly see that being one. The other thing, we didn't talk about this last week, but I wonder what's going through the mind of the district court judge here in Riverside, if she at all anticipated that this maelstrom would ensue from her issuance of what she might have viewed as a pretty routine discovery kind of order in a criminal case. She has a U.S. attorney's background herself, probably is used to issuing orders to help the U.S. attorney in their investigations. And I wonder if she saw this coming or not.
One more thing, was interesting was that a lot of focus was given to the idea in the hearing that we're creating warrantless zones, or, you know, places where warrants can't reach. And I think that this, you know, along with the assumption that firewalls are just rules that govern how they control their data, and, you know, today's or yesterday's cyber pathogen, all of these are just indications to me that the real problem is that, you know, we don't have policymakers that understand the technology. We need a real primer on cryptography, because we've had, you know, warrantless areas since cryptography was, you know, created, and we argued about this 10 years ago. You know, it is absolutely, we know for a fact that we can make that. So that's not the issue. That shouldn't be the issue. If you're just figuring that out today, then where have you been paying attention to? I just think that's depressing, distressing.
Well, it's
hopefully
good that
this all turns out.
Good. The House committee had its hearing this week for 4 hours. Maybe some of the more junior members got up to speed on the fact that we have been here and done this. Let's move on and talk about some copyright cases. We have a real soft spot for talking about tattoos and copyright here on This Week in Law. And we're lucky to have Mike with us today, because you've spent a good deal of time thinking about and analyzing this issue. There is a lawsuit pending now. Well, why don't you tell us about it, involving LeBron James?
Sure. So this recent case that was filed just a couple of weeks ago involves tattoo artists that had placed their tattoos on various NBA players, including LeBron James and Kobe Bryant, as well as several others. There's a video game that's put out 2K, NBA 2K, I believe the name of the video game is, that has Kobe Bryant, LeBron James, their avatars in the video game environment, and of course includes the tattoos that have been etched on their bodies. So the claim from the plaintiff is that, look, I've put the tattoo on these various NBA players, but I haven't given anybody else the right to reproduce those tattoos. And I certainly haven't given the right to the video game manufacturer to reproduce my tattoos, my artistic work, as part of the avatar of the in-game experience. So the plaintiff filed this lawsuit seeking damages, seeking injunctive relief, saying that NBA 2K16 is infringing on the artistic works that, again, are etched on the flesh of these various NBA players. So it raises really some very fundamental questions as to, can copyright extend, or should copyright extend to tattoos that have been placed on the human body? And interestingly enough, although tattoos have been around for a long time, and of course the Copyright Act has been around for centuries, we don't have any clear case law guidance on this issue. There's been a prior case involving, some of your viewers may recall, a case involving the tattoo that was on Mike Tyson's face that was reproduced mm-hmm. as part of the Hangover 2 movie. And the tattoo artist sued in that particular case seeking injunctive relief. And ultimately, the court denied the preliminary injunction, saying, well, for a variety of reasons. But ultimately, that case, I believe it settled without the court ultimately deciding the core fundamental copyright issue, whether a tattoo artist has copyright protection in a tattoo. So that's kind of the legal issue teed up in a nutshell, Denise.
Right. And I love your post on the TMCA blog that talks about how at first blush, you would think that tattoos would be something that would be available for copyright protection. You know, they're a creative work. I guess the other layer of copyright here that could come into the tattoo discussion is whether they were created by the tattoo artists themselves or lifted from somewhere else and merely transferred onto someone's skin. I suppose they'd have to clear that hurdle in order to sue. But assuming that they could, you would think at first blush, okay, yes, it's a creative work. It is recorded. It is in a fixed medium. But
where is it?
Yes, but Professor Nimmer, one of the copyright gurus of the world, doesn't think that someone's skin could be a medium of expression. You want to fill us in on that, Emery?
Well, I thought that was so interesting. I had not been following the Mike Tyson case when it came out, so reading David Nimmer's declaration was super interesting. So in that case, a tattoo artist actually written out a license, contracted with Mike Tyson, I think, to license out the tattoo that was on his body. And I thought it was interesting in the declaration that I was reading, I think that the tattooist described the copyright in the copyright registration as tattoo on 3D form, the 3D form being Mike Tyson's mug. So I thought that was really interesting. And yeah, you know, I think at first blush, I was on the camp that would think that this would be copyrightable in the sense that almost everything is, and the bar is usually pretty low. But, you know, it's creative work fixed in a tangible medium. The issue comes up is whether or not a human body can be a tangible medium, because if the courts say that they can, and they say that tattoos are copyrightable, then there's a whole host of rather problematic issues that could come up. For example, Mike Tyson is photographed by a newspaper. Do they have to license out the tattoo that they photographed from the original artist? What about documentaries? If Mike Tyson has then consented to allow them to take his photograph and use in the documentary, is he then contributory negligent? And if he has a tattoo on top of it, or if he modifies that tattoo, is he now in violation because he's made a derivative work? So these are all really sort of interesting high-level copyright ideas. And honestly, if you're at all interested in it, go peruse David Nimmer's declaration from the Mike Tyson case. It was great.
Can I handle some of those questions?
Please do.
So again, can you just repeat why? What's Nimmer's argument that the skin is not acceptable media for copyrightable work?
So Nimmer's what makes skin different than paper or?
I could paint a painting on rice paper that's going to disintegrate within a short period of time, less than skin will. So, I don't understand.
He analogized it to trying to. Cases like writing a novel in the sand before the tide comes up and washes it away, and writing poetry on a pane of glass. I think those are both examples that he's written about before. And it's also interesting because his opinion on this has I don't want to use flip-flop because we're in silly season, but his opinion has changed as well. He said that originally he had opined that it would be copyrightable. He had included in a footnote in one of his previous writings that, yes, it should be copyrightable. But I think that he's really coming out on policy arguments, saying that at the implications of what could happen if a body is determined a medium of exchange, he said it gets wrapped up in sort of prohibitions on slavery and the user's or the individual's ability to have control over their body. And what could happen if they, again, are, you know, photographed or display their own tattoos or modify their tattoos or have additional tattoos put on them. He said it would just really complicate the matters. But I would love to hear your opinion on them because I think it does bring up a lot of interesting issues.
Yeah, these are not the most unsolvable problems I've ever heard of. With regards to the lasting aspect of skin, go to the beach, go to a pool and look up for a 90-year-old person and look at the tattoos on their body and think of how long they've lasted and then think whether the sand is a good analogy in that situation. With regards to the knotty problems, sure, there are knotty problems. But I would imagine that if I were to go see LeBron James in person and took a photo and he's walking outside, there has to be a certain concept of implied license. If he doesn't want people to take pictures of his body, then he should stay, you know, indoors. It's the same thing like putting something on the web. There's a certain implied license based on the medium in which you have chosen. So if you have a tattoo on your face like Mike Tyson did or on your arms and you're a basketball player, there has got to be a concept of a certain implied license. As to whether you are going to reproduce it for commercial purposes like a video game where you are not forced to reproduce the tattoo in order to create an avatar, different issue. So I think that these problems are solvable, and the argument that they seem a little weird to us is not a good argument. I don't see the policy argument to deprive tattoo artists of copyrightability in that situation.
Well, Mike, you have written about and talked about the implied license issue. Here it would be flowing from the tattoo artist to the person getting the tattoo, that if you have the original creative work and you're the tattoo artist and you apply it to the person, you're giving them a license. And I suppose by extension, anyone who photographs or uses their image, do you think that that's how this might go?
Yeah, so I think the implied license argument is interesting. I mean, we typically think of implied licenses as being very narrow in scope and flow directly from, say, the artist to, in this case, it would be LeBron James. But I think in the context, the implied license argument could be interesting here, because if I'm a tattoo artist and I put a work of art on LeBron James prominently somewhere on his body, on his arms, or somewhere else where it's visible, I know very well that that is going to be reproduced in all sorts of manners and ways. For example, I know it's going to appear on television because, of course, when you play basketball, you play with your arms exposed. So I know that that tattoo is going to be broadcast through various networks. I also know, as a tattoo artist, that a world famous athlete like LeBron James, he appears in video games and has for years. So I think that there's a fairly compelling argument. I wouldn't be ready to say it's going to take the day, but I think it's a fairly decent one in this context, that as a tattoo artist who places a tattoo on the body of a very famous world athlete, that you have impliedly consented to that being reproduced in other works that are consistent with what that professional athlete does. TV right. network reproductions, and even extending to video games potentially. So for my money, that's probably the more interesting question here. I do agree with Marty that, you know, conceptually speaking, a person's body can very well be a tangible medium of expression. I like his notion of the, you know, somebody on the beach that's 90 years old that has a tattoo. Of course, it's going to be fixed. I think Professor Nimmer's examples about the transitory nature of a novel written in the sand, I don't find that as compelling because, yes, if something's written in the sand, we know it's going to be there for a short amount of time. It is going to get washed away once the tide comes in. Not so with a tattoo that's etched on a human body. Now, maybe if it's a removable tattoo or it could, you know, just disappear when water hits it or something, maybe that's a different issue. But a permanent or semi-permanent tattoo fixed on human skin, I think there's a pretty decent argument that that's subject to copyright.
I was wondering actually about that because I was thinking body painters or people mm-hmm. that, you know, paint themselves silver and are like living statues on the streets. Like that would, if following David Nimmer's argument, they wouldn't be copyrightable because it's not a medium, fixed medium. But mm-hmm. yeah, so glad to hear the second.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good distinction that's more, you know, the writing on the window example, as opposed to something more fixed. As we've had this discussion, I keep, and you're talking, Mike, about how you know that this person's going to be on TV and the parts of them that you have put your art on is going to be on TV. I keep thinking of how, you know, in almost every television show that you watch where real people are featured, you know, reality TV, I don't know if news does this as well. Maybe they feel like they get a pass on this because of fair use in the First Amendment. But reality TV, certainly, if someone's wearing a T-shirt, if someone, you know, there are all kinds of instances where you see logos and images and other potential third-party IP blurred out on TV because either they don't have the licensing or they don't want to give the endorsement. They haven't been paid to advertise for that thing, but they blur out things all the time. Is there a parallel here that might come into these tattoo cases? And since you both do work in the trademark arena, what if the tattoo artist used like the tattoo parlor's trademark and put that on LeBron James? Would we be having a different conversation here, Marty?
No, then the tattoo artist would be paying money to the video game publisher because of the...
Because they're getting the free advertising, right? Yeah. I don't know. I think it's always a fun issue to talk about the IP protection in people's tattoos. I think it has a lot of different epidermal layers. Any final thoughts on this, Mike, before we move on?
Nothing further at this time.
All right. We're going to make LeBron's body art our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. We put these phrases into the show in case you are a lawyer or another professional who's listening for professional credit in your field. You can demonstrate to any oversight board that you've actually watched or listened to our show and not just sort of stuck down our March 4th episode on a list somewhere as something you may have watched, may not. We put these phrases in so that you can demonstrate. There will be another one a little later in the show. And if you need more information about being a lawyer seeking continuing legal education credit for watching the show, head on over to wiki.twit.tv and find our This Week in Law page there. And you'll find all kinds of information on the various jurisdictions in the United States where you might want to apply for credit. All right. One other interesting copyright story, sort of a cautionary tale on extending the DMCA and things that might be more part of daily life if we do so. This comes from Mike Masnick over at Tech Dirt, and it was actually written up per him. I haven't read these pieces. I've only read his coverage, but at the Washington Post and the Daily Dot as well. And it involves a Twitter account called dog_rates, which rates dogs. And the photo on the Tech Dirt page has a nice representative post with a very cute looking puppy called a draconian jabberwocky, which I've never heard of before, but it's quite an adorable dog. And anyway, this Twitter account apparently gave this particular puppy an 11 out of 10, and how could you not? But also, apparently, this Twitter account has a non-fan, a troll, which started sending DMCA notices about certain posts and trying to censor what was going into the Twitter feed. And actually, the author of dog_rates wound up negotiating with this troll and taking down a couple of tweets just to get the person off their back. But as Mike points out here, that the takedown powers that the DMCA has might not be used to prevent trolls from trollishness, but might be used affirmatively by them. Emery, any thoughts here?
I mean, nothing surprising. color me absolutely not surprised. This is right. Run-of-the-mill trolling. I mean, if you... His troll replied, "Enjoy your account. Sorry about that. I'm just one of your old followers. I'm going through a tough time. I'm really sorry."
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is someone that is just sending out a DMCA complaint because they can.
Clearly no copyright interest here. You know, I suppose if you had taken pictures of your dog and had not licensed them for this use, that you might have something to talk about here. But that's not what happened. Marty, any thoughts?
So I found that I lost a couple of hours looking at the rating dog Twitter feed trying to prepare for this. And I actually did wind up sending a picture of my dog to them in the hopes that he would rate it. right. Where's the Jack Daniels Terrier?
So in doing so, you did not expressly give a license to their use of the photo of your dog. It's probably not Creative Commons license.
This is a situation where it's just more important that people admired my dog than I maintained, you know, copyright in its image. So, you know, right. We all work for different reasons, right? So I'm always distressed to hear about this. I've written articles about the DMCA, and I'm actually a very pro-DMCA kind of guy, and I'd actually like to extend a DMCA-like regime to trademark law. But I acknowledge that there's some fundamental problems with the DMCA, and among them is the low threshold that you have to establish in order to make a claim. And there's also problems with accountability of – I mean, I don't think we can make a troll-proof remedy in any facet of life. So when I hear these stories, I'm sorry that occur, and they tend to be arguments for a better DMCA and not really an argument against the DMCA. So there. Let's go back to looking at dog pictures now.
You know, this is an issue that I think has been sort of boiling to the under the surface recently, especially on Reddit and YouTube. In the past couple of weeks, you've seen a number of posts fly to the front page with videos of content creators complaining about the YouTube's policies regarding the DMCA. And I'd really be interested in hearing your take on this from someone that is in the pro-DMCA camp. What sort of remedies we can come out to sort of, if we can't make this troll proof, how do we make this better than what it is?
So one of the problems is the low standard for the copyright that you claim. Now, there kind of needs to be an ability to do a common law copyright claim, because I have situations where clients have loads and loads of content, all of the pages on their website. It's not particularly feasible that they are going to file copyright registrations weekly or what have you. And then they find someone who's done a counterfeit version of their website. There's a need to be able to assert copyright prior to formalities. Having said that, if you go through the problem of asserting a claim at that time, I think that the level of affidavit that DMCA requires is a little bit too low. And then the business about making a completely malicious claim, that there's just simply no teeth. I won't even say insufficient teeth. There's just not enough teeth in making a bad faith claim. And as far as I could tell, bad faith claims certainly exist. And I think those two critiques alone are enough to really warrant a you know, revision to a technical correction to the DMCA Act.
Marty, do you think it's enough that we have law, at least in the Ninth Circuit now, that requires copyright holders to go through their own fair use analysis before sending a DMCA takedown, and for them to be confident that there's no good fair use argument before they go ahead and fire away? Now, I think that's probably a requirement that's honored more in the breach than the keeping, but at least a court has come out and said it.
So your audio cut out during part of your question, but I'm assuming you're talking about the Dancing Baby case?
Yes.
Yes, okay. So I think that that decision was not as clear as it could have been, but mm-hmm. it's the right direction. How about that?
Yep.
I mean, I think a clever lawyer could get around the Dancing Baby case. How about that?
All right. Yes, I know what you're saying. Mike, as we've been talking through this, I keep imagining the cute little draconian Jabberwocky dog somehow pushing the button on a GoPro and taking the pictures of itself, and how that would contribute to our discussion here, the doggy selfie as opposed to the cat selfie.
Right.
You want to add anything to that or anything else on this topic?
Well, we, in terms of animal selfies, we now have actual case law authority that animals, through their surrogates, cannot claim copyright protection in their own selfies. We know that from the monkey selfie case out of the Northern District of California that was just recently decided. So that issue's been cleared up at least temporarily.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's only in one circuit. I want you to know that I have been lobbying for groups of monkeys trying to get a class certification, and we will be we're not leaving this alone, okay?
All right. Good to know.
I look forward to that. That'll be fun.
All right. We're gonna move on and consider Cartman and Rush and the relationship between the two of them in just a moment. But before we do that, we're going to thank our first sponsor of this episode of This Week in Law. Ring Video Doorbell is our sponsor. We're familiar with the sound of a doorbell. It means a package is being delivered or friends are coming over for dinner. But it's also the sound, potentially, of someone planning to rob you or otherwise with ill intent toward your residence. Over 95% of home break-ins happen during the day, and burglars almost always start by ringing your doorbell to see if someone's home before pillaging your possessions. With the Ring Video Doorbell, you can see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. Ring's advanced motion detection alerts you even if someone doesn't ring the doorbell. So if someone is just lurking or casing or otherwise just shouldn't be there, you'll get these motion detection alerts on your phone, and you can check it out and make sure everything's okay. You can also talk to the person at your door when they ring the doorbell. You can answer, and you can choose whether to tell them you're at home or not, or anyone's at home or not, which comes in very handy if you have packages that need to be delivered, if you have neighbors that are dropping by, et cetera. It's great to be able to interact with someone who's trying to reach you by coming to your front door, even when you're not home. It's like having a neighbor keep an eye on your home 24/7. I love having the Ring Video Doorbell at our front door. It was super easy to install. The battery life on it is great. It works wonderfully with your phone. I now know it has its own very distinctive ring sound on your phone, so you know in a moment that you're not getting a text, you're not getting an alarm, but there's someone at your door, and you know how to answer that once you take a look at who it is. I definitely have had instances where I've needed to tell UPS and other package delivery people what to do because it was their third attempt in the case of UPS of trying to deliver a package. And it's great. It just gives you a great sense of security and being able to monitor your home, even if you are far from it. So I think you should put your mind at ease and protect your home with the video doorbell that Time Magazine and USA Today named one of their top 10 gadgets. Go to ring.com/twill for free expedited FedEx shipping. That's ring.com/twill. With Ring, you are always home. Thank you so much, Ring, for your support of This Week in Law. Right, let's. We're going to keep on the copyright theme, but move it over to Hollywood. All right, I had so much fun when I saw this post from Laughing Squid, which highlighted a Redditor who attended a Rush concert and filmed some of it from the audience. I'd like to play some of that for you now.
Let's get this party started. And a one, and a two, and a one, two, three. Oh, one, two, three. Oh, yeah. Modern day warrior named Tom Sawyer. He floated down a river on a raft with a black guy. Hold on. Stop. Those aren't the right lyrics. Tom Sawyer built a raft and floated down a river with a black guy. I read the book. That's not Tom Sawyer, that's Huckleberry Finn, stupid. I am Geddy Lee, and I will sing whatever lyrics I want. Just start the song again, and this time do it right. Fine. And a one, and a two, and a one, two, three, a one, two, three.
So Rush comes in to save the day there. So they've decided to kick off their iconic Tom Sawyer song there with the clip from Viacom/Comedy Central's South Park. And when I saw all this, my IP lawyer's mind just about exploded because there's so much to unpack there. I thought it would be fun just to go around the horn here and issue spot what's going on here. I posted on Facebook that I hope my law professor friends will take a look at this and use it in an exam, because I think someone could write probably quite a bit about the copyright issues that are presented here. And I'll toss one out just to begin with, the whole notion of the Redditor himself, who took this footage, uploaded it to YouTube. It's still there. We still played it, even though content ID is bound to flag it on either the use of the South Park clip or the use of the Rush music. So there's another instance where the DMCA might be this person's nemesis. And thank goodness it wasn't our nemesis here on the show, and we were actually able to play the clip for you. I'm fairly confident in our fair use ability to use all of it, because we're talking about it from a scholarly perspective here. So next IP issue about this clip. How about you, Marty?
I'm busy. I have my blue book open, Professor. I'm still writing down some of the issues that I just saw. All right, so the Redditor, the larger problem for the Redditor would probably be breach of license, and that the act of buying the ticket probably involved a contract not to mm-hmm. use that device in mm-hmm. the arena. Mm-hmm. Had there not been a breach of license, you're just a human being and you have a camera and you're taking pictures of the things that are around you, and you would have a certain fair use right to say, this occurred, this is what it looked like. So you'd be able to display a certain amount of a clip. The minimum amount that you needed to communicate the valid point that Rush did this really funny thing. And that then the real Rush came on. So you might need to reproduce the entire South Park clip and then just a few seconds of the real Rush. So that is from the point of view of the Redditor. How many points do I have? How much time is left in the exam? Russia's use of the South Park clip. All right, so we're going to assume that the South Park clip is copyrighted. There would be a really interesting copyright issue to the extent that this came up last week. Only the copyright owner can make a derivative work. If you make a derivative work without authorization, then you do not have copyrightable subject matter. So at first, South Park's derivative work, its own lyrics, would not in and of itself be protectable. On the other hand, they would probably have a parody defense to that. So that would be the hidden issue of, does South Park own copyrights in its own lyric? All right, now Rush would have a certain fair use right to show the clip enough to communicate to their fans, say, guys, South Park made fun of us. So they would be allowed to use a certain portion of that. Then you have this whole sync music problem, which I don't even want to get into. So I'm just going to close up my – I'm just going to close the blue book and throw it in.
Right. Sounds good. Mike, anything you want to add?
Yes. Yeah, so I believe there's a provision in the Copyright Act that deals with unauthorized fixation of musical performance. And I can't remember exactly what it is, but I thought there was some provision in the act. Again, it's been years since I looked at it, that may be problematic for whoever actually did the recording at the concert. Mm-hmm. So I think that's in addition to the issue that Marty had raised about the implied license not to record when you're at the venue. So it's really funny. I mean, obviously South Park makes its living off of doing parodies of third parties. So now that it is actually, I don't know if you'd call it a parody, but now that it's on the other side of the fair use argument, I got a good kick out of it and liked your Facebook post on it, Denise. It was fun.
Yeah. Emery, anything to rev up here about Cartman?
I've got nothing. That was some great input.
Yeah, I think it's so fun. You know, a great example of just the kind of use that happens every single day and how many layers of it there are to unpack. Let's move on to right of publicity and some recent cases on that. One involving the Hurt Locker, a new decision out of the Ninth Circuit. Can you tell us about that, Mike?
Sure. So this is a case that was just handed down by the Ninth Circuit within the last week or so. And the Hurt Locker, of course, Academy Award-winning film that is based on the story of these soldiers that valiantly fought for the U.S. in Iraq and that went and were responsible, this particular division was responsible for clearing IEDs from roadways and other places. The reporter, stepping outside of the film for a moment, there was a reporter that was embedded with a particular platoon or division during the Iraq War. And the leader of that particular division was a fellow by the name of Sergeant Sarver. And he was the leader that would go out and deal with these improvised explosive devices and clear them. And he and his team did some pretty amazing things there during the war. So this reporter actually wrote an article based on his embedded experience there. It ultimately wrote a screenplay that became The Hurt Locker. Now, the name of Sergeant Sarver wasn't used. There were apparently some vague references to Sergeant Sarver or aspects of his life. And the reporter that wrote the screenplay never got a license or permission from the real life Sergeant Sarver to use any facets of his life in the story. So Hurt Locker comes out. It's a huge Academy Award winner. And ultimately, the producers of the show and various other folks in the chain of distribution were sued for a violation of the right of publicity by Mr. Sarver. Ultimately, those claims were not successful. There was a slap motion, which is a strategic lawsuit against public participation motion that was filed. It was granted by the district court and ultimately upheld by the Ninth Circuit. And what the Ninth Circuit essentially held here is, look, this is a core speech protected by the First Amendment. This is a film about a very important political and war type situation that was covered by the makers of the film. It kind of falls right into the sweet spot of the First Amendment. So it receives kind of the highest degree of protection under the First Amendment. And the court said that's something that we're going to value and we're going to protect the right of the filmmaker to make, even assuming that. And I think the court was skeptical as to whether any of the particular facts about Sergeant Sarver were included in the film. But the other thing that the court said and why it was throwing out the case is it said, importantly, that Sergeant Sarver, during his lifetime thus far, has not tried to commercialize his story, has not tried to do anything to actually go out and commoditize and sell his story to others. And because he hasn't done that, that was an important facet of the court's decision. It said, look, he hasn't gone out and tried to do anything with his story, and we're not going to stop the movie producers and everybody else from telling a similar type of story about the Iraq War. So it's one of the many cases that are dealing with the right of publicity right now. There's a case actually pending before the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court's considering it for review. It's another Ninth Circuit case involving professional football players that sued a video game producer for violation of the right of publicity. There was also a recent NFL case that just came out within the last week dealing with NFL players' right of publicity against NFL films. So very hot, interesting area for sure.
Yeah, that NFL films one is interesting because there, while they might have had a right of publicity claim, if they could establish certain things, here the court found that it was actually preempted by copyright law, that the fact that the NFL had a copyright in the films that it made, you know, historical clips of great games, that kind of compilation is what was at issue here. And they have a copyright in that eliminated the possibility of a right of publicity claim. It also mentioned the court here something about the commercial aspect not being satisfied, that a right of publicity claim usually involves someone misusing your name and likeness for their own commercial gain. And certainly that seems to be a factor. It could have, should have been a factor in either of these cases, but the court said no, that films are somehow not a commercial enterprise or not the kind of commercial enterprise that we're anticipating under right of publicity law. Can you speak to that, Mike?
Sure. So you're right. I mean, historically and traditionally, we think of somebody's right of publicity being violated when a third party is using that image to hawk goods, you know, put somebody's face on t-shirts or mugs and then selling those for the pure commercial value associated with that image. But we also think of a violation of right of publicity when someone's image or name is used to advertise a particular product or service. So what the court said here in the NFL case is this isn't either one of those situations. This is really pure speech. It's not commercial speech. They are putting together this compilation of prior games involving these players. And this is, again, something that falls right into the core interests of the First Amendment. Now, interestingly enough, in the court's analysis, it also acknowledged that the films themselves are a commodity. It goes into a discussion about how, in fact, NFL films or NFL actually licenses and sells these products to third parties and makes quite a bit of money. So it is still a commercial product. It's just not the type of commercial product, according to the court, that we're going to be too concerned about because it has some pretty substantial expressive elements associated.
Okay, let's make substantial expressive elements our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. And let's move on to another right of publicity case, this time impacting the social web. We've talked about the website Avvo before. It is, if you haven't checked it out, it is a social network rating system. It's partially a Yelp for lawyers. It's also a way for lawyers to interact with each other and clients. And it's got some LinkedIn-esque aspects to it. Interestingly, it is not something that people necessarily opt into to be part of. The way that it works is Avvo takes public information about attorneys in the United States, which the various state bars maintain. And it cobbles together very rudimentary, not fleshed out profiles for attorneys and includes them on the site. And then as an attorney, you can decide you're going to claim your profile or you can just ignore it and leave it alone. People who claim it generally have, you know, bought into the what Avvo's doing here and have decided it's a good idea to add some substance to their profile and perhaps interact on the site or not. But it has rubbed people the wrong way because of the way it has decided to populate basically a social network and networking site with publicly available information rather than having people, you know, sign up and decide, yes, I want to be part of Avvo. So they have been targeted on their ratings aspect unsuccessfully on a couple of fronts. Now we have an attorney who's asserting a right of publicity claim and saying his name and likeness are being commercially used without consent. So what do you think about that claim, Mike?
Well, I'd like to quote from a fellow a lawyer, Ron Coleman, who wrote on his blog, quote, mm-hmm. her right of publicity case seems very much to stink, end quote. I think that's probably putting it pretty well. You know, mm-hmm. the right of publicity, as we were talking about a moment ago, is really dealing with commercializing on somebody's name, image, or likeness. I mean, what we're dealing with mm-hmm. with Avvo, whether you are a fan of Avvo or not, what it's doing is it is collecting information, aggregating information about lawyers, and then providing that information to the public so it can make some sort of informed, reasonable judgment as to whether it wants to retain a particular lawyer or law firm. So the fact that her name is used and it's culled from publicly available information, and the fact that there may be other lawyers that appear in close proximity to her bio, that doesn't transform this into a right of publicity case, from my perspective, at all.
Marty, do you think we would be having a different kind of discussion here or have a different take on this if instead of Avvo and the world of lawyer information, we were talking about the general public, and some social network decided to try and populate its database by using publicly available documents, tying your identity to maybe property that you own and whatever else they can do just from county or other publicly available records, and then trying to have a commercial social network that lived off that data and the option to claim your profile or not. But if you don't, your name and likeness are still part of what's making that commercial network happen. Would it be different?
So kind of having a hard time imagining your hypo, though, about a non-commercial situation.
I think it's commercial. It would have to be right. Commercial.
So the fact pattern, you just raised about 18 different issues. So mm-hmm. you picked a good fact pattern. Mm-hmm. I want to get back to something that Mike was talking about first when he was talking about the Hurt Locker. At least in New York State, although now they're called the civil rights laws, we have like the companion tort to the right of publicity, which is the right of privacy. And when we're in law school, we're taught that catchy phrase, intrusion upon seclusion, which is that the people have a right to commercialize their name, persona, and likeness, but also a negative right to prevent it. I guess the most recent case, oddly enough, went the anti-privacy way, in which a artist, a photographer, took pictures into people's windows, and they did not have a claim about the windows were open. It was like implied license. But when you were describing this, it sounds to me like there is at times a certain right not to be publicized and not to have information exposed about you. Sometimes it has to be in a false light. So a private citizen may say, okay, you can't put me on this list if you are impliedly saying something bad about me. So there's mm-hmm. that false light tort, which is one thing that, again, with the Blue Book, when you're giving me that fact pattern, Professor, that's one of the issues I was going to try to get some points on. The Avvo thing, first off, I'm interested, how did they use the likeness? You said that the lawsuit involved the person's name and likeness. What I would imagine that on Avvo, my name is in the publicly searchable list of New York State lawyers. But my likeness isn't. And if someone were to publicize that in connection, I would say there's a false endorsement there. There's this implication that I signed up for Avvo when I didn't, in addition to any kind mm-hmm. of copyright aspect to it. You know, I'm also reminded that my wife is a clinical psychologist, and someone got their name off, you know, New York State's licensed psychologist list, and they matched them to our phone number. You can imagine how much we enjoyed having our home number attached to that. And we changed our phone number and got it unlisted. So there are certain professions and certain sort of situations where there is the potential for meaningful tort damage if mm-hmm. aspects of their lives are reproduced. And of course, there's always copyright ability issues when public databases are used in some way. Mm-hmm. So how many points did I get for at least issue spotting?
Good number of points. You're doing very well on your exam today, Marty.
Andrew's class.
Yes. Mike, he raises a good point about images. I've never claimed my Avvo profile, and they don't have an image of me. Are there other lawyers that they have images of, even if they're unclaimed?
You know, the complaint in this Bernstein case was not clear. I actually did look at this lawyer's profile, and there is no image of her. It is mm-hmm. just the publicly available information from the Illinois State Bar Association. So mm-hmm. you're really talking about kind of bare bones information, stuff that you would have, you know, akin to information that's in a phone book, for example, publicly available information about this particular individual. Now, the interesting wrinkle, though, with Avvo that takes it out of kind of a phone book type of context is, of course, mm-hmm. Avvo has its own secret sauce, if you will, about how it goes about rating lawyers. There mm-hmm. is this kind of back end machinery that kicks in, and you will get a rating on Avvo whether you like it or not. And some people haven't liked their ratings. The very first case that was filed against Avvo in Seattle was by a Seattle lawyer that said, I'm a great lawyer and I got a very low ranking on the Avvo system. And that case went nowhere. The district court judge in that case said, look, these are the types of value judgments or opinions that are put together by Avvo that are protected under the First Amendment. There was a subsequent case also in Seattle where Avvo was taken to task. Again, Avvo prevailed. And there's a pending case in California, another slap motion that was filed. It's a right of publicity case. And, you know, so far, Avvo's batting 1,000 in defending these cases.
Hmm. So all I can think about now is that Avvo's secret sauce is they have the guy from rate_dogs doing the ratings.
Good lawyer, 11 out of 10, would pet again.
Perfect.
Mike, I am curious, though. We have someone in the chat as well that's chimed in and said that, you know, their other website, zoominfo.com, for example, they scrape info off the web and have been getting the information incorrect. I know that I would be interested, as successful as Avvo has been fielding these arguments before, do you think that that's going to continue? Do they really have free reign to just say whatever they want? And I'll leave that to you.
Yeah, I don't think, Emery, that it's necessarily they're saying we can say anything we want about you. I think by and large, these cases haven't been about false information. It's not like, you've said that I lost a jury trial when I've never tried a case, or it's nothing like that, at least as far as my recollection goes. It's really just about aggregating all of this information and using it in a commercial context, which seems to raise the ire of some of the lawyers that have gone after them. But I do think at some point, if you misuse the information, or if you're saying information that's just flatly not true about the lawyer, mm-hmm. that's a completely different species of tort. But that's not a right of publicity issue just to have somebody's information aggregated on a website about lawyers. I just don't see it.
Right. Yeah, I don't see the right of publicity claim here either, although I don't think that Avo's legal problems are necessarily at an end, because I think people are going to try and keep finding theories because they don't like what Avo's doing. And I, to some extent, I kind of sympathize. If Facebook and LinkedIn were populating its databases with bare bones information about the general public, I don't think people would be happy about it. There are plenty of other databases that do that, but they're not also social networks involving ratings and endorsements and things. I think that's where it starts to rub people the wrong way.
Go ahead.
So the other thing I'd add on that point, Denise, is I could see a distinction between a third party that wants to aggregate information about John Q. Public versus mm-hmm. aggregate information about a particular sector of society that offers important services, i.e. doctors and lawyers, for example. So mm-hmm. it seems to me it's fundamentally different, that there is a very significant public interest in knowing information, factual information about lawyers and doctors and other people that provide important professional services. So that it seems to me there's a fairly significant distinction between that scenario and the scenario that you're mentioning about aggregating information about anybody off the street.
Yep, I totally agree with you there. And I also would add that, you know, state bar sites where you might be looking up information might not be anywhere near as nice a user experience as something like Avo. So there's something to be said for that aspect. Since we've got two folks on the show who love to talk about trademarks, we have a couple of, I think, interesting trademark stories we should delve into here. Three words, Mike. SpongeBob's, two words, SpongeBob's ukulele. Tell us about it.
So this is a recent case that just came out dealing with, it's another, I believe it's a Ninth Circuit case, if I'm correct. I just wrote about it. You would think I would remember. But this was a case involving Gibson Guitar. For some of you that may be watching, Gibson Guitar, or Gibson Brands rather, has various trade dress registrations and various trademark registrations on the shape of its guitars. And so when a Viacom licensee, Viacom is the entity that publishes SpongeBob SquarePants through the Nickelodeon channel, Viacom licensed a third party in the UK to reproduce SpongeBob on various products. And this company ultimately created a, and I have it right here. Oh, you've got it right there on the screen. Yeah, you see on the screen there, that is the SpongeBob ukulele that was reproduced by this third party in the UK under a license from Viacom, which again, Viacom owns the trademark and copyrights associated with Nickelodeon and SpongeBob SquarePants. So what happened is Gibson Brands sued not only the UK company, but sued Viacom. And the theory on Viacom, or against Viacom, was, look, Viacom, you granted a license for this third party to use the SpongeBob SquarePants trademark and the Nickelodeon trademark, and therefore you're contributorily liable for their infringement. And what the district court held and what the Ninth Circuit ultimately held is no, that's not correct. Viacom may have licensed the use of SpongeBob SquarePants, but it wasn't actually actively involved in the process of creating the infringing product. It didn't have any authority over the licensee to dictate how the product was going to be manufactured, how it was going to be marketed, or any other sort of significant indicia of control over this allegedly infringing licensee. So ultimately, the case was dismissed against Viacom, and that dismissal was upheld by the Ninth Circuit.
Excellent. Marty, anything to add?
This is an inside baseball trademark case. Just, mm-hmm. you know, to do the basics for the audience is that quality control. I mean, one of the first things on trademark licensing 101, quality control. So Viacom is going to accept money to allow the ukulele manufacturer to put the SpongeBob trademark on a product. For this to be deemed a real enforceable license, Viacom has to, as they say, exert quality control. It's not a particularly high threshold. It tends to mean that they get a sample and they go, oh, no, you got the colors wrong, or, you know, you didn't reproduce it in a good way. That's the extent. I mean, they could say, I reject the sample, go do it again. The SpongeBob trademark is not the subject of this case. The trademark that was being infringed is the alleged trademark in the Flying Z guitar that Gibson owns. This is as unenforceable as if, you know, there was some patent infringement inside the body, or if the wood was illegal, you know, mahogany or something. That's not the level of control. It's not within Viacom's ability to inspect. So that is sort of a rationale for why Viacom doesn't exert that kind of quality control over the Flying V ukulele.
Okay, good to know. We're happy that SpongeBob.
I said it was inside baseball.
Yes, exactly. I'll talk about anything that involves SpongeBob's ukulele. I'll also always gladly embrace our second trip into the world of rock and roll for this episode, and check back in with the Slants, who we've discussed previously on the show, who got a win on their First Amendment challenge to the cancellation of their trademark. And they get to call themselves the Slants, and they get to get a trademark calling themselves the Slants, taking back that racial slur through their use of that trademark. I just wanted to point out that they – what? Yes, please.
The way you said they get to call themselves the Slants.
Don't they? They got to do that before.
That is going to be a very important distinction in this case if it goes up to the Supremes, which is that the PTO would make the argument they always got to call themselves the Slants. And just like if the Redskins trademark were to be canceled, they would still be able to call themselves the Redskins. And I know that this – I'm trying to be just precise about the legal issues that are getting set up here, and I'm emphasizing that exact point because that's how I see the arguments coming down if it were to go to the Supreme Court.
Do you think it
which
will?
Is that the government? So you've got the Fourth Circuit taking the Redskins case. You've got the Federal Circuit taking the In Re Tam thing. I can see them not coming out exactly the same. It's such an important case that, yes, I could see it going up. And the setup is, is this a content-based government restriction on speech? So if the government's argument had been, well, look, the Slants will still be able to use the name. Redskins will still be able to use the name. What we're doing is they have two arguments. We're not giving them this bundle of benefits, namely the various privileges that come with the federal trademark registration. Then there's this other argument in In Re Tam that the PTO approving a registration is a form of government speech. So in other words, that's the Texas license plate rationale.
Right.
And what In Re Tam saying, no. Saying that something is not registrable is equivalent to saying that it's not protectable. Saying that something is not protectable will seriously impinge your ability to call yourself the Slants. So that's why I wanted you to kind of emphasize that the Slants would argue if we lose this case, we can't call ourselves the Slants because it's no longer a protectable trademark. Mm-hmm. And that's an issue that we don't have final word on in these two cases. I'm treating them as a single issue.
Right. But for the time being, they have been awarded a trademark, correct?
For the time being, they are presumptively the owners of the trademark. And for the time being, Section 2A, the scandalous prong, is presumptively unenforceable.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there's like a lot of scuttlebutt in trademark circles today because it seems there's now a logjam of lots of trademarks that are subject to 2A rejections and they're all suspended. Mm-hmm. So the word on the street is nothing's going to happen under 2A until both In Re Tam and the Redskins are finally disposed of its cases.
Great.
What do you think?
Mike, anything to add?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's obviously raises very important issues. You know, a lot of times when the Supreme Court accepts a case, it's because there is a conflict between two circuits. This case is kind of interesting because the Federal Circuit actually is the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals that has control over the Trademark Office and any appeals from that, unless you went to a district court. But in terms of registrability, the Federal Circuit is really the final word. So I think regardless of how the Redskins case comes out, there's a pretty compelling argument that the court should still accept this case to clarify whether Section 2A is still viable. Another interesting aspect of the court's opinion is, and this was an en banc decision, it wasn't, there wasn't a unanimous decision here, but there were seven or eight judges that signed on to the majority opinion. And what the court really held here, I mean, it held a variety of different things, but what it emphasized is, you know, we as a society and maybe as a judicial system have given short shrift a bit to trademarks. I mean, trademarks are not just commercial speech. They are actually imbued with much more meaning than pure commercial aspects. And that was a fairly significant aspect of the court's decision from my perspective, that it's not just commercial speech. They're very much woven into the fabric of our society these days and very important. And registrations carry, when you get a federal registration, you have some pretty significant rights that the federal government has granted you. And Simon Tam and his band were denied those important rights based on this content restriction. So it's going to be great, very interesting to see how this all plays out.
Yeah, it sure is. And in the meantime, the Slants are about to tour Asia for the first time. They've got a crowdfunding site where you can support their ability to take that tour at generosity.com if you are so interested. And I did not give Victor much of a heads up to play some Slants music for you so that you can see that these folks are talented and definitely worthy of following regardless of their name. But maybe he's got it queued up. You want to play just a little Slants for us, Victor, if you can? For just kind of rocking out to Slants for the rest of the show. They're so good.
I had a question, I guess. If I could throw that towards our trademarks experts. I'm not asking you to predict the future, but assuming this does come up to the Supremes, could I get both of your feel on how the outcome would play out? I'm interested in the Redskins trademarks debate. I think that's something that has to be decided.
I'll let Marty go first.
The argument that registrability equals protectability seems to be a case of first impression. And it seems to be one that you cannot deduce the answer from the statute or without extensive research of the history of the Lanham Act. I just don't know the answer to that. And I think that you can just decide. If you decide that registrability equals protectability, then you will find that it's a content-based restriction on speech and fine for invalidating 2A.
Okay, Mike, your take?
I think the majority opinion puts together a very, very compelling argument that this is a content-based restriction and it failed to pass strict scrutiny. I just don't. I think it's very compelling. I would think that the court's going to be hard pressed to find that this overturning the court's decision. So. If I could say one other thing, Denise and Emery, about Simon Tam, we actually had the pleasure of working with Simon. He was at Dorsey & Whitney in Seattle just last month or at the end of January. He was a panelist on a CLE that we put on. He's a tremendous guy, a very knowledgeable when it comes to First Amendment and Section 2A. I mean, he seems to know the cases and the history of Section 2A as good as well as, if not better than most lawyers. So if you ever have a chance to have him on your show, it would be a real treat for your listeners.
Oh, that's a great idea. We should, we should ask him on.
I'm happy to make it.
I have just two more things to add.
Yes, please do.
I was just reminded by something that Mike said, which is that in thinking about last night's debate, this country's what constitutes acceptable public discourse is very much different than 50 years ago. There were things that were said last night that are just unthinkable to people from 50 years ago. And candidly, I think a lot of 2A has to do with the fact that these registrations make us feel icky. You should probably get Mark Randazza on your show, and he could, at the top of his head, list 50 applications or registrations that are vulgar. And then his view is that that's just not a valid criteria for the PTO granting registrations. And in a way, the definition of what is vulgar has changed so much and so rapidly, it may be acceptable to say it is not a valid criteria. So at least the scandalousness portion of 2A, it's just not a valid way to regulate speech at this time. The other thing was, and I've always felt this, just knowing how long cases run, which is that the Redskin trademark issue is not ever going to be resolved legally. It just takes too long, and, so what if they lose their registration? As I said, there's just not going to be a situation where someone says you may not – there's not going to be a court saying you may not call yourselves the Redskins. I do believe that the trademark is racist, and I do believe that the Washington Redskins have no good reason not to change it. I think change will come about through people refusing to buy Redskins merchandise. So this is a situation where – the solution will not be in the courts. Okay.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. All right, I think we're going to move on to our resource and tip of the week. Our resource of the week is courtesy of Marty, and you alluded to it earlier, Marty, that you've written an article, you've co-written an article that describes having a notice and takedown system for trademarks. What will people learn when they go and read your piece?
They will learn that I'm consistent because I wrote the article several years ago. The article will just say that, first off, expedited dispute resolution is a good thing, that things such as the DMCA and the UDRP for domain names have the potential of resolving important infringements of rights with a minimum of resources, and when properly prosecuted, that is a good thing. And then advocating that the DMC-like and UDRP-like procedures be implemented for trademarks. So this is an article that was in The Trademark Reporter. And if you were to Google my name, Schwimmer, and my co-author, Mostert, or something like Notice and Takedown, you will find copies of that article. And thank you for the plug.
Sure, you're welcome. And you'll also find it in our discussion points for today. Everything we've talked about today is at tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw, including our tip of the week, which is courtesy of The New Yorker, which has done a list of things that will be acceptable for journalists to write about candidate Donald Trump once he has managed, if he follows through on his suggestion that he is going to, quote, open up those libel laws. The New Yorker has a helpful list of things that will be proper under a Trump libel law regime, such as Donald Trump has good ideas. I agree with President Donald Trump. Donald Trump knows money. He's great with money. The best. His house is gold. I'm off to write Donald Trump a nice letter. Other such things in the same vein. All alluding, of course, to the fact that among the various eye-opening things that candidate Donald Trump has been saying is a notion that here's his exact quote: "We're going to open up those libel laws. So when the New York Times writes a hit piece, which is a total disgrace, or when the Washington Post, which is there for other reasons, writes a hit piece, we can sue them and win money instead of having no chance of winning because they're totally protected." So I think that suffice it to say that Donald Trump's understanding of the libel protections for journalists is a bit flawed. If you're wondering about laws that he plans to change, there's one that he's said that he wants to. Any thoughts on this, Marty?
Well, I think you know that I had that one-liner that here we have the party of small government wanting to federalize libel law.
Mm-hmm.
That was my initial reaction to that.
Yes.
I mean, I have a lot of reactions to that.
Yeah.
Some of which, there is a economics professor named Tyler Cowen, C-O-W-E-N, and he wrote one of the underreported aspects of the prospects of a Trump presidency, which is that one thing we kind of don't worry about all that much is what he refers to as the vindictive regulator. I don't doubt that certain regulated industries have a certain fear of speaking out against the agencies that regulate them. And we know that there are allegations that agencies, in particular the IRS, have what's referred to as political agendas. I don't know the underlying facts as to whether, you know, the IRS did target the Tea Party, for example, but we know we have those allegations and we have fears. We know that Trump threatened Fox on multiple occasions with regards to the content and quality of their coverage, so that the threat to open up libel laws is consistent with the somewhat reasonable apprehension that a Trump presidency would have the vindictive use of a regulatory apparatus. So I'll leave it at that.
That's an uplifting thought to leave our Friday on. Mike, can you give us anything more optimistic to think about this or no?
I don't know if I have anything more optimistic to say. I mean, when he says open up these libel laws, I think what he's saying is we're going to have to roll back the First Amendment, because under New York Times v. Sullivan, of course, if you're a public figure, you have to show that there's actual malice associated with the publication about you. So as I understand it, that's kind of been the law of the land since 1964. So I'd say Mr. Trump may have quite an uphill battle in getting past that and opening up those libel laws, to put it in his words.
Right. Hey, do you see any parallel between what you just mentioned, the standard of being a public figure? You have a heightened level of proof of wrongdoing in a defamation case. Do you see any parallel there between what we were talking about earlier with these right of publicity cases and the protections of a public well-known performer versus an average citizen?
No, I mean, to me, I kind of look at those as two distinct issues. I mean, when we're talking about libel in the context of a New York Times v. Sullivan case, we're talking about a tort that has been committed against a person that has somehow defamed them or has somehow portrayed them in a false light. When we're talking about right of publicity, we're really talking about the commercial use of someone's name, image, or likeness. So, I mean, to me, they're fairly separable, and they're in two distinct legal arenas, essentially.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. I just always have been fascinated by this notion that our law makes distinctions based on whether you're a public figure or not, and I think that's getting harder to put one's finger on. Well, certainly Donald Trump is, so it wouldn't be hard in this situation.
If there ever was one, was anyone that invited it.
Yes, exactly. All right. Well, that's going to be it for this episode of This Week in Law. We've had a really fun discussion. I hope you've enjoyed it. Thanks so much for joining us, Mike Keyes. Anything going on with your firm or your practice that you want to let people know about before we head on out today?
Oh, wow. Well, I'm a partner at Dorsey & Whitney in Seattle. Copyright, trademark, and advertising is what I do. And I really appreciate being on your show today. This was a lot of fun and great to be with all three of you.
Great to be with you, too. We really appreciate your time. And Marty, great as always to catch up with you. Anything going on in New York and Leeson and Ellis that we should know about?
Anything that's interesting, it's still a pending matter, and I look forward to talking to you about it when it's no longer confidential. But
yes,
thank you, and I hope you guys are all going to look at that Twitter feed at Trademark Blog. That tells it all. So thank you very much, Denise.
Absolutely, too. And I'm sorry we didn't get the time to go into. We had a few other things we were going to dig into today, but do check out Marty's Twitter feed because one of the things he's been doing is looking at abandoned trademark registrations registered and then abandoned by Donald Trump. Have you been able to reach any conclusions based on your research into that, Marty?
He's clearly got the best people working for him. I mean, the best. I was actually looking to see whether John Oliver did in fact file for Drumpf. And I was looking at all the abandoned ones. Trump Vodka, Trump Shuttle. He's had a lot of businesses. And he always files lots of versions of them. You know, it is interesting is how much public information is available about him. And it's very easy to go onto Pacer and look at the various Trump University lawsuits. We hear that the Republicans didn't go after him because they were busy doing their Oppo research. And I was reading the Trump University docket sheet, a year ago. So if you guys are interested, go out to Justia. And then go look up Trump, and you'll find all of the public lawsuits against him. So go to dockets.justia.com and use Trump as your search term, and there it'll be all the times he's been sued.
Right, and you think you lost time on the dog rating site. I think you've just established, what some of us will be doing this weekend. Thank you so much, Marty, for joining us. It's great to see you as always.
Thank you, Denise.
Emery, great to see you too. Hope everything is going well at school. You're getting into the spring term here.
Yeah, everything's going really well. It's hitting that time where it's about to get very stressful. I'm getting married in a month and happy
Yay!
To be here.
So, I know, that's awesome. As though you didn't have enough on your plate.
Yeah. I like to keep busy, Before I head out, I want to make sure to do a shout out to the Twit survey. If all of our listeners could. I know that Twit every year puts out a survey. Your answers are anonymous and it helps this station grow. So if you go to twit.tv/survey, I know it would help us all out quite a bit. And
thank
with
you
that,
so much for that.
As always, it's been an absolute pleasure to have me here. Thanks, and I'll see you next week or so.
Yes, you sure will. If you're watching us live on Friday, that means you joined us somewhere around 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1900 UTC. That's when we start the show. And we'd love to have you join us every Friday when we record. If that's not possible, don't worry. You can head on over to twit.tv/twill and find our archive of shows. You can also go to YouTube, in iTunes, however you would like to watch the show. There are good suggestions if you're looking for, hey, how might I watch the show that I'm not already doing? If you head on over to twit.tv/twill, there are all kinds of ways to subscribe, enjoy, whether you're a kickback on the couch and watch on Roku kind of person, or I need to stream live and be there for every moment of the action, or I like to work out and catch up on Twill and subscribe in iTunes. They're all available there for you. We love too to hear from you on those various sites to rate the show or give us feedback on the show. That's always nice to hear from you there as well, and to hear from you in email. I'm Denise at twit.tv, or you can find me on Twitter, D Howell over there. Emery is at Emery Roan on Twitter. Let us know what you thought of our treatment of these topics, or other topics you'd like us to cover, or guests you'd like us to have on the show. I made a note that having Mark Randazza and Simon Tan on an episode would be another excellent pairing, so we'll work on that. Also, we just love your suggestions, your thoughts, your feedback on the show. So please get it to us in whatever way works for you. We're also on Facebook and on Google+. So as I said, you know, however you do it, get in touch or just enjoy the show. Come back with us week after week. We're happy to have you, thrilled to have you. So glad that we're able to do this show every week. It means a lot to us. We hope it means a lot to you. And we will see you next week on This Week in Law. Take care.